News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
I'm on Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. A little bit later, we're going to have Jamie Dimon with us, the CEO of J.P. Morgan. It's going to be great. And an interview with Lucas Zinger. You might not know his name, but you should know his company, Divergent Technologies. They use 3D printing. 3D printing to make weapons for pennies on the dollar. They have 30 Pentagon contracts. It is beginning to revolutionize the way we mass produce weapons, and they have contracts with major firms, so they're not necessarily substituting for them. But, of course, Operation Epic Fury is underway. Yesterday, I don't know if you've seen the explosion, but they got the Isfahan power plant. It looks like a weapons depot, but underneath is the nuclear fission. This was a massive explosion. It was a direct hit. Just fascinating to see what's going on. They were able to hit 1,000 targets in 4 hours. That is because of AI. We have never seen anything like this. This is using Claude, the system there, along with everything that we've been doing. The Pentagon has folded this in like we've never seen before. You use that along with the drone technology found that the Ukraine has initiated and innovated over in the war with Russia. And you have a revolution happening now with war fighting. A little scary. We got to stay ahead of it, but it shows you how much you have to stay ahead of it. Meanwhile, the Strait of Hormuz, we're looking at 3,000 ships that are still waiting to pass in. We're getting about, I don't know, 20 a day going through, and I think they're paying a toll to get through, which is abhorrent. But unfortunately, right now, the Strait of Hormuz is not controlled by us, which is something that's got to change quickly. And we know that yesterday, a Kuwaiti barge was hit. It was the 18th hit. Since this whole war began just about a month ago. But the president, I don't believe this Wall Street Journal story that says the president of the United States is considering finishing up and still leaving the Strait of Hormuz unopened, letting somebody else open it up. That, to me, has no resonance. That's according to aides who told the Wall Street Journal. To me, that is a head fake because we are building up troops big time in the region. We just put the 82nd Airborne, a few thousand there. Two ships full of Marines numbering about 5,000 just got in. That's a totally different take. In fact, here's Marco Rubio on where we're heading right now. He sat down with Al Jazeera on the Strait of Hormuz. Cut to.
As the U.S.-Israeli campaign continues, there's no clear indication that the Strait of Hormuz is secure enough to restart the flow of oil and gas into global markets. Are you considering a plan to ensure full control over the entire strait?
Well, the Straits of Hormuz will be open. When this operation is over, it will be open, and it'll be open one way or another. It will be open because Iran agrees to abide by international law and not block a commercial waterway, or a coalition of nations from around the world and the region, with the participation of the United States, will make sure that it's open. One way or the other, it's going to be open. But we have very clear objectives that we're trying to achieve here. Those objectives are the destruction of their Air Force, which has been achieved, the destruction of their Navy, which has largely been achieved.
It's largely been achieved. We've got to get rid of those smaller boats. That is going to be huge. Also, the unmanned boats, which could be moving explosive. You do that one time and then no longer can get insurance to get those barges through there. And we know that. But we're going to have to do something bold with the islands, whether it's blockading them, the Karg Island or the others, or it's just flat out taking them or destroying absolutely everything. I mean, you have to see the difference now in what Iran has been going through. We do not have eyes on the ground there. So you have no idea what's happening. All you're seeing is, well, Turkey had to knock down drones that were heading their direction. And we hear a Kuwaiti ship was hit and a Saudi base was hit. And we think they're on a roll. But they're not on a roll. They've lost 250 commanders. 250, including their Ayatollah. And the number two in charge is too scared to come out or too wounded to be out or might even be dead. Oil exports. People say that Iran's making more money now. They were putting out 2 million barrels a day. Now it's 1.2. Revenue was 3 billion a day. Now it's down to 2. Inflation, 120%. Currency collapsing. It's almost useless. Public workers are unpaid. Army is unpaid. Banks have disrupted frozen funds in the Arab states where most of them kept their money. ATMs are flat out running dry or have very little cash. That, to me, is approaching total knockout. Now, the president, Pesquion, is evidently having huge problems with the IRGC hardliners. He wants to go one direction. The hardliners want to go a different direction. They were most likely are death cultish, and they want to just end up on a stretcher, on a gurney, in a casket. So that's a different approach than the president. You guys work it out. But it makes me feel pessimistic about anything working out with talks in Islamabad. Here's what Marco Rubio said about that. Cut one.
Well, there's messages and some direct talks going on between some inside of Iran and the United States, primarily through intermediaries, but there's been some conversation. And I think the president always prefers diplomacy, always prefers an outcome. And we could have done this before. I mean, imagine an Iranian regime who, instead of spending billions of dollars supporting terrorist groups and building up all these weapons, had invested that money into Iran, for the people of Iran, so they wouldn't have water shortages, so their economies would provide opportunities for an incredible people.
But they're never going to do that with this regime in charge. And what the president's point yesterday was, we already have regime change. We already killed 250 of their top commanders. In fact, the new leader, the supreme leader, he's not an Ayatollah, the son, came out with a statement about condolences for the family of the IRGC commander who he said was his friend. Well, that's what we got to do. We got to knock out all those commanders who have been lying to us from years, who have been making ballistic missiles at a dizzying rate and been able to create havoc in the region. And now they are holding on, but they're not doing well. So I think that's important. We don't have an idea what's happening, and we have the Pentagon press conference. We'll bring back some of that throughout the show today. But the other big story is the DHS. We do have a shutdown, but the president found some money to pay the TSA agents. Reportedly, they even got back pay already. Not all of it, but a lot of it. Most of the lines at the airports around the country have decreased. But for some reason, the Senate and House have no plans to come back in emergency fashion, which kind of makes me sad because the president bailed them out and got rid of the urgency. So Chris Coons showed up to make sure there was a negative voice to make sure the House CR, which would have paid everyone for 60 days, did not go through. And afterwards, he was cornered by the press. Listen to how this ends. Cut eight.
How do you justify being off for the next 2 weeks? We're 45 days in. Can Democrats and Republicans keep affording to play this blame game?
You know well that we're not off. We're working every day in our home states. For most of us, this is when we have the time to go up and down our state and to meet with our constituents
but
and listen to their concerns.
But people aren't getting paid, sir, so
ma'am,
don't you owe,
let me finish
don't you owe it
my
to
answer.
Them?
Thank you all very much. Great.
You can't walk away. You finish. I know you do things. I know you're not off when you go home. I know that. But you can't go home if you don't have a resolution. Democrats caused all this. The disconnect between Republicans in the Senate and Republicans in the House caused the fracture. But the whole standoff is because Democrats don't want to do what they signed off on through the appropriations. And that is pay all of DHS, not just the part you like. I love that the Delta Airlines CEO sat down with Liz Claman and talked about how frustrated they are and what they're doing now to Congress, who used to get a free pass to go past TSA. Cut 11, Ed Bastian.
Given the lack of leadership that we've seen coming from our elected officials, the fact that we would continue to extend courtesy opportunities for them to bypass the mess that they've created. We want to make sure they understand what they're and stand in line just like everybody else.
How long will the pause continue for those perks?
At a minimum, until everything is back and running normally, the workers are paid, and at that point we'll decide whether we continue it.
Yeah, well, you can't be going past the lines that you caused. That's impossible. I love that Delta's doing this because it's unbelievable. This is unrelated. If, you know, you're a strike and you're in a steel union, you're on strike and, you know, you're making a stand and the other side is management and they're making a stand and then you worry about families feeding, but you both made a stand and you knew what you were getting into. This is like watching a bar fight and the guy turn around and punching you in the face. You did nothing except wait for a drink. Here's more. Cut 10.
We are beyond frustrated at the lack of leadership that's coming out of Congress. Thank God the president enacted an emergency order to ensure the TSA workers are paid. Hopefully in the next day or so, they will start to receive that back pay that they so rightfully deserve. I appreciate the work that they have done. I appreciate the patience of our customers that have to go through this ordeal, but it's a travesty.
I can't say he's overstating it. He's not hysterical. He's not trying to score points. He's not trying to show that his airline's better. This is just outright frustration. American or, Frontier, whatever you are, affordable airlines or the luxury airlines, it's you're forced to put yourself in line for 3 or 4 hours. I mean, I don't even know how you time it. So if everybody's thinking to themselves, okay, I'm okay, everything's back to normal, and then you show up in Baltimore on Sunday, like what happened, and you're there for 4 hours and you miss your plane. And you know what? Whether it's business or pleasure, that screws you up like no one else. And you got to go home, get a car, got to go get a hotel, and then you got to come back the next day. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, the CEO of Divergent. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
A talk show that's real. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, it's my privilege to welcome in Jamie Dimon, Chairman and CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. He's got a great initiative. We're going to talk about it in a second. Jamie, thanks so much for coming in here. We truly appreciate it.
Brian, I'm thrilled. You already had a good day already.
So, I know. Yeah, we were on Fox and Friends earlier. And also, I know for a fact, you get up at 4:30. You've already read how many papers?
Five.
And that's normal. Do you write physical papers or online?
Yeah, I do it online because the physical papers don't come early enough. And also, they're not updated.
Right.
So I used, and literally until about a year ago, it was always physical.
So it's Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, and The Economist?
New York Post. I got to do it because I read most of the pictures. But New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, in that order. And the Financial Times, because it covers the world.
Right.
Other ones aren't very international. Of course, we operate in 100 countries around the world, so I need to remember what's going on everywhere.
So we just watched the Pentagon press conference together, and people are concerned about the economy and where we're at right now. We have gas at $4. We have the market's around 45,000 today. I'm not sure what it's doing right now. Are you concerned about the economy today? And what areas please you, what doesn't?
Yeah. Well, I think, look, not really. There are some positive things taking place. When we talk about the economy, there are hundreds of factors that affect it.
Right.
And gas will be one. It's a negative, for the population, more for the lower income folks and everybody else. But you still have jobs. You still have huge capital expenditures. You still have tax benefits coming to families. Right now it looks pretty good. But the most important factor is, we have huge deficits. We have these geopolitical events. How long this war goes on. Those things can easily change the economy. But for now, we don't see it.
Have you felt the difference with a businessman in charge? Even if it's a businessman that makes decisions different from a politician. Have you felt that?
Yeah. I mean, if you talk about the president, they have some very good people around them. They make decisions. They know the real world. They put some very good people in some of these jobs. I mean, we've dealt with Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent. Excellent. A lot of his staff is excellent.
Did you know him ahead of time?
And by the way, I'm not telling you, I agree with everything they all do, but they're really capable people. I did not know Scott, no.
What's interesting is I was listening to David Sachs, and he said, it's so interesting because we bring up the president with a problem, and he wants to solve it right there.
Yeah.
Isn't that the way you run things, too? How do I solve this? Who do I get on the phone? How do I fix it? Who do I do? That's not really how a politician traditionally focuses. Yeah. Let's get a meeting together. Let's go to that committee.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. I mean, we do lots of analysis and deep dives and facts before we make certain decisions. So I don't actually know his decision-making process. I'm not in the room. But I do know he likes to take action. And, and that's a wise thing to do.
So tell me about what J.P. Morgan had to do.
And a very important thing. I think it's, when I look at our government, I think it's important to have people in the government who've been in the real world, who've had to deal with, and that's whether it's doctors, sometimes lawyers. You can't have all economists and lifelong politicians because the real world isn't the same as the theoretical world. And, how mankind operates and what regulations actually do to people and what works and what doesn't work and how you deal with bad people and not everyone's good. You and I were talking about how this government was formed by our founding fathers. They were brilliant, but they knew that not all men are good. They prepared for how we could prepare for the fact that not all men are good. How do we make sure that the majority doesn't cripple the minority and create a civil war type thing? And so, so I think it's good to have people with deep experience going back and forth. We used to have much more of that 30, 40 years ago. And that kind of stopped over time, much less of it.
I want you to hear what Kathy Hochul said recently. I thought about you, the governor of New York.
I need people who are high net worth to support the generous social programs that we want to have in our state. Right? Now, there are some patriotic millionaires who stepped up. Okay, cut me the checks. I mean, just if you want to be supportive, but maybe the first step should be go down to Palm Beach and see who you can bring back home, because our tax base has been eroded.
So how do you feel about that? First, she said hit the road if you don't like high taxes, and now she's saying we need you to come back.
I think a good politician should realize that you need a competitive state to build and grow businesses. And you've seen, if you look at it, Texas is growing, Florida is growing. They like business. They have incentive systems and taxes that bring in business, and it helps all the citizens of those states. You know, and that's the biggest mistake, that somehow punishing business is going to help lower-income people. It doesn't. And you've seen people leaving. People vote with their feet. It is a free country. They have the right to do it. They're not immoral, because they say, I worked hard for my money. I want to pass more of it on to my kids. And we have to be very careful to act like you're immoral, because you want to do that.
Do you worry about the mayor who only talks about raising taxes? Yeah, well, he doesn't think billionaires should exist.
Yeah, no, I saw that. The rich have done very well. And I do think it's legitimate to say, that the lower income haven't done very well, and that we as society should do something about that. The way to do something about that is to grow the economy, create opportunity, teach kids in high schools, with certificates that give them jobs and cyber. And that's the way you do it. Driving out business isn't the way to do it. Sounds good. So, mayors either learn, look at the mayor of Detroit. He said, they had a terrible problem, highest unemployment. And he said, anyone who can help me, business, civic society, schools. And we called him up and said, we're in. What can we do? And we work with him. And, of course, the credit goes to lots of people. He turned the city. That's how you fix a city. And so some mayors learn how to do that and some don't. Some are so wrapped up in their ideology, they're unable to actually figure out what works for the citizens of the place. So.
And we're going to talk about this when we get back, but the American Dream Initiative is really all about that, isn't it, ADI, what you guys are doing?
Yeah.
How much money are you putting in? How many programs?
It's a lot, and we didn't announce a number because we don't, a lot of it's mortgages, and that goes up and down all the time, but it's mortgages, small business loans, affordable housing, one of the biggest affordable housing lenders in the country, but it's also branches where we bring people in for financial education. And then we also work with local schools. How can you get kids jobs that are high-paying jobs at 18? And that could be, be advanced manufacturing, aircraft, cyber. And there are tons of them that are open today all around the country. So to me, it's all those things, small business, affordable housing, financial education, skills. And very importantly, we call it vital institutions. But we're one of the biggest financiers of schools, states, hospitals, and cities, and, for governments generally. So. And that's a really important part of the infrastructure, what makes society good for people.
As like low classes, you write, and we'll talk about it in a moment, they have to deal with more crime, they have to ruin bad schools, and they got to deal with bad health care. And it's not right. And you guys, that's part of the reason why you're taking JPMorgan Chase, which I think is a $4.4 trillion company, and trying to help out the entire country. That is the way you do it patriotically, in my view. Jamie Dimon is going to be with us with a few more minutes. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show on a great Tuesday. Don't move.
Get in the game with the college-branded Venmo debit card. Rep your team with every tap and earn up to 5% cash back with Venmo Stash, a new rewards program from Venmo. No monthly fee, no minimum balance, just school pride and spending power. Get in the game and sign up for the Venmo debit card at venmo.com/collegecard. The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. Select schools available. Venmo Stash terms and exclusions apply at venmo.me/stash terms. Max $100 cash back per month.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think the housing market is important here because we see interest rates are rising. We were talking about mortgage rates being below 6% just about a month ago. Now they're heading in the wrong direction, 6.4% about for a 30-year fix. This is a problem for the spring housing market. Already we knew that affordability was tough, meaning prices surged during the pandemic, interest rates surged after that, and the affordability has become a problem. So people are now spending about 42% of a median household income on housing. Can I tell you something, gang? 5 years ago, that was 28%. So when you look at that, you say to your young people out there, don't kill yourself to buy a house. Sit still. It is not affordable right now.
Well, that's Jill Schlesinger on CBS talking about housing and the rates going slightly up. Jamie Dimon's here, CEO of JP Morgan Chase. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, you know, it's fixable. You know, we've been telling the government for years, and you and I have spoken about rules and regulations, the excessive rules around mortgages. If anyone signed a mortgage recently, like the signatures, the papers, the documents, the security, increased the cost of that mortgage probably by 30 or 40 basis points. And we've spoken to the government about we should fix that. The other thing is affordable housing is much more expensive than it should be because of usually local zoning. You know, they make it a jobs program. You have to use unions. You can't have a second floor. And so affordable housing, like in California, is literally 50% more than it would be in Nevada because of their rules. And so if people, they give lip service to affordable housing, but then they don't fix it.
Right.
And so there are a lot of things to do to fix these problems.
Growing
the economy, you know, you have already mentioned to me, we have to have growth strategies that would get more income into people's hands. They'd be able to afford more. And it would also, if you have more productivity, it's actually deflationary. Good growth can be a little deflationary because you're adding productivity.
Understood. And with the housing market, the Jay Powell says, I'm going to stay pat when it comes to interest rates. Was that a good move?
Yeah. You know, I don't think they really have a choice right now. Remember, the Fed has to look at data, and the data right now says that inflation is still running at 3%. It would be a little peculiar if they cut it right now. But if we continue to grow and, you know, if gas prices come down eventually, yeah, they may very well cut rates.
Do you think there's something you learned from the Strait of Hormuz being such a factor now with global energy prices that we change? For example, Saudi Arabia has redirected some of that oil through the Red Sea. We know there's a pipeline there that allows them some flexibility. Would you hope we address this?
Yeah, well, hindsight's a wonderful thing. There are a lot of things that we should have done differently around security, resiliency, energy. You know, Europe is hugely reliant on liquid natural gas from the U.S. and from Qatar. And so in hindsight, they built one pipeline that goes to the Red Sea, carries 7 million barrels, but you could have built a lot more so that you're not reliant on the Straits of Hormuz, but it's too late to do that right now. So that would, you know, take years and years to do. So, you know, there's a lesson is that these people have been threatening the world for a long time. And I shouldn't say threatened, because when I hear that word threat, it's like they didn't do anything. No, they actually killed and murdered people all around the world, including Americans. So on October 7th, when Hamas went into Israel, a lot of Americans died that day. And, you know, of course, the Houthis, the Hezbollah, Hamas, you know, they've been fostering terrorism. They've tried here several times. The world should have done something about them. We just found, look, I don't know what the military knows, what the government knows, but we just found out they had a ballistic missile go 3,000 miles. They could. If
that's
they had
every capital in Europe.
Yeah, exactly. If they had a nuclear weapon, now that it's not just the Strait of Hormuz anymore, it's like, and these are killers. These are not people who just want to protect themselves, and they're fanatics.
But Jamie Dimon, when we're in nuclear talks, there was a big pushback, even from the IRGC, saying, "Well, they're not really. They're looking to get a nuclear energy program, not a nuclear weapons program." And then we find out they were at 60% enrichment, and they have 640 kilograms of it that could make 11 bombs. And those are their own words. So everything that we suspected ended up being true, if not worse.
Yeah, everyone knew they were liars. But again, I still think the government probably knows more than we know right now. And one day we'll probably find out.
Yeah.
So I'm not an expert in nuclear proliferation. I do know if you had nuclear proliferation, that's probably the worst thing that could happen to mankind. If they actually had a nuclear weapon over time, so would Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt, a bunch of other countries, eventually South Korea, Japan, Philippines, Vietnam. If you actually have that kind of proliferation, mankind will be in tough shape.
All right, Jamie, I do want, for people that are just tuning in right now, one of the reasons you're here today is that you have this initiative going forward, the American Dream Initiative to expand local and economic opportunity, because right now our numbers that we have, that only 32% of the people listening to us right now, Americans, even though we're heard internationally, 32% of Americans believe in the American Dream. You want to change that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, they should step back and look at this unbelievable country of ours where, you know, if we open up our borders, billions of people are coming and want to be American. But we should also acknowledge our flaws. It has been framed for the lower income, mostly for the lower income third in our country. Their schools aren't good enough. They're not getting jobs. And we should do something about it. This has happened, by the way, over 40, 50 years. Even after the war on poverty started, it didn't really work. We have to acknowledge that and do something about it. And this is our part. So we're going to do more mortgages, more education. We have 25% of our branches in lower income neighborhoods. We bring the people in to teach them. We've got a community manager who walks around, gets to know the businesses and the religious institutions. We're going to go from we bank 7 million small businesses to 10 for any 1,000 new bankers. And we're doing it quite locally. So the first place, and I forgot when I'm going down, is Alabama. We started opening a branch in Alabama. I visited L3, making the THAAD missile down there. So we do things for schools, financial education, skills.
Why Alabama, the greatest need?
Yeah, we looked at what could we do, and it's new to us, so it's, we always learn we do something. So we learned from Detroit. Go in a very comprehensive way, deal with the governor and the mayor, look what their needs are. The needs are always different locally. It's a bad idea for a big company to say, this is what we do and this is how we're going to do it. In certain parts of the country, they need other things. And so if you go to Alabama, there's some cities doing great. There's some cities not doing great. And, the lesson is have the policies that make it great. And a lot of it's around education.
The one thing we understand, my daughter's a teacher, fifth grade, and the one thing that happens is in lower class, working class areas, they pay teachers by the property taxes.
Right.
And the property taxes, if you live in a working class area, your property taxes, the revenue is not high. Yeah. So therefore, the teachers get paid less. The schools don't have as great accommodations. Yeah, sometimes states come in and help out, but for the most part, not only are your parents making less money, but you also have the work against you. Your teachers aren't getting paid. Logically, you would think the higher paid teachers go to the places so that we get more money. That's the American way. So you see all this happening. This is stacking the deck against people who already have the deck stacked against them, not making it impossible, but you're just trying to level out the playing field a little bit.
I mean, it's a shame. And I agree with you. Real estate tax was part of that. How we pay teachers is part of that. All these policies we put in place didn't work for a lot of people. So I tell a lot of my friends, you don't worry about your schools. You don't worry about crime. You don't worry about your kids. There's none of that. But you go to an inner city or certain rural areas, they have more crime, less jobs, worse education, somewhat because of real estate taxes. And we, all of us, government, but I think business too, should take part of responsibility saying, how can we fix it? We do it mostly commercially. Most of what we do, we make money in those cities, but we bring knowledge and loans and business and we have small business consultants. So if you ever want to start a small business, they help you. Where do you locate a restaurant? What's the best place to do it? How do you sign a lease? How do you get a contract with the federal government?
So where would they find you?
In a branch. There are 5,000 branches around the country. We're in all 48 states now.
And they would walk in and just say, tell me about this. Tell me about the American Dream Initiative.
Yes.
And they just ask for it.
They can ask for it. They can open an account. We run mortgage seminars or investment seminars And it's all on the web. So you can go look at JP Morgan Chase and see what we can do and how we can do it. We want to be a great corporate citizen. We want to build JP Morgan. We want to build America. We're all quite patriotic. This is part of what we think is our job. It was always the job of a bank. It's to finance society to grow and expand and grow, help business. And the other thing your listeners should know is that capital formation is what drives productivity and growth and jobs. When someone builds a plant somewhere, like they're building this plant, which we helped them do in Detroit, a new car plant, like the first one in 30 years or something, there's going to be 5,000 jobs in the plant. There are going to be 25,000 jobs outside the plant supporting the plant, from people.
Restaurants.
Exactly. Barbers, but also consultants and electrical and plumbing and all these things you need to have society. But those 5,000 jobs drive a lot of jobs in Detroit.
Don't you think a lot of these mayors don't seem to understand that? The mayor of Chicago, the mayor of New York City, the mayor of Los Angeles, I don't think they fully understand that.
Yeah, I think my experience with mayors is a lot of them didn't have run these big bureaucracies when they got the job. And now all of a sudden they're in this job and they have ideas and they sold themselves and they're good politicians. But now you got to run a job with the bureaucracy. And good people learn, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that it's going to be about the schools, the crime, the hospitals, the subways, getting local business to want to stay there. That's the job. It's not ideology. And so some learn and some don't. And sometimes I'm surprised that they don't because you think they should. Sometimes I'm surprised that they do because you think they wouldn't. But if they're blinded, by ideology, it'll almost always fail.
And I know, Jamie, you got to go. But my last question is you in the big picture. You're not ready to retire. I know that for a fact. You've said it many times. But at one point, you're always into challenges. If the right opportunity came to serve in government, would you ever have you thought about running for president? The field is literally wide open on both sides.
Look, obviously it's been mentioned to me a lot. I think it's kind of I love what I do. And remember, I love that it's quixotic to run for president.
Very patriotic.
I'm not a quixotic kind of guy. I think from this perch, I could do a lot of stuff to help my country and everyone here and stuff like that. So So the answer is no. I'm not really thinking about doing that. And I applaud the people who do it, but it is hard.
Would you be a Democrat or Republican?
I don't know. I would not be an ideologue of any sort.
Understood. Jamie Dimon, thanks so much. And thanks for what you're doing. The American Dream Initiative is now out there. Find your local branch. Find out more about it and see how you can maybe have some resources for the first time in your life to make your life better than whatever it is right now. Jamie, thanks so much for the quality time.
Brian, great day with you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Back in a moment.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. Join Fox in supporting our troops. From daily needs to global emergencies, help us be there for those who serve. Visit go.fox/Red Cross to donate to service to the armed forces today. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
What is one action that Donald Trump took that is impossible to do under the Constitution, but he did it anyway?
I can't name specific laws. I'm sorry. I lost a lot of thought on that.
You're a reporter, so why don't you do your homework? Don't ask me.
Went to war.
Legally, he could do that.
He can?
Putting ice in our cities.
Legally, he could put ice in cities.
I don't really give about legally.
Rename the Kennedy Center.
Which amendment under the Constitution is he prohibited to renaming the Kennedy Center?
I refer you to the New York Times 2 days ago. They had a list of 30 items.
And you read it?
I read it, absolutely.
Yeah. So what is one thing from that list?
One thing from that list is I'm blanking.
Yes, you did blank. The No Kings rally is farcical, and now we find out that billions, literally billions, were put in from outside sources. And you're watching these people in New York City with communist flags. Are you an idiot? You pro-Brezhnev? You want Stalin is the good old days you want to bring to America? Or do you think, I don't know, was Yeltsin somebody that you really want to get under, get some of those policies going? It works so well in Cuba. It's really fantastic in China. And man, is it really humming over in Russia? I mean, we're seeing communist stuff. The Communist Party is financing it. And the Democrats are more than welcome. They call that a big tent. You can't let communism into your tent. You can't let Islam... the Islamic extremism into your tent. It's incredible. But I do want to talk about what's happening in the war right now. The Pentagon had a meeting. I didn't get a lot out of it. The Pentagon had a press conference. Some of the questions are interesting. There's a lot of optimism there that they're finishing off this target. We have to soon find a way to get that strait reopened and get the uranium out. I think both those things got to happen, or they got to be secured. How are we going to do that, and what exactly have we done already? I will say that the one problem I have that also shows the success we're having, there really is no one voice. We've killed, along with the Israelis, 250 of their leaders, including almost all their higher-ups. We're down two or three versions. The current president, who we've allowed to live, is a so-called moderate among radicals who is for these talks, but the IRGC isn't. So what's the sense of talking to the president if the IRGC is still going to act? Now, let's see. How are they acting? Yeah, they shoot a few rockets to the desalinization plants in Kuwait. I assume that's intentional. What idiocy, but go ahead. And I shoot any place in Israel they think is a good target. What about Turkey? Yeah, you hit Turkey yesterday. What about the fact that the Strait of Hormuz is so chaotic? You stopped three Chinese ships from coming through. They're the number one benefactor. They're the only people, for the most part, who have been buying your oil through the sanctions. So if you look at what, and by the way, the UAE is privately pushing the President of the United States to put in ground troops. They want these guys finished off for good. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain feel the same way. I love it. Those are called real allies. NATO, I'll tell you, it's a crisis moment. Spain has blocked the airspace to military flights over Iran, and they're not letting us use our airbase. Do you believe this? The Spanish defense minister confirmed the move, saying Spain has denied airspace access and the use of joint U.S.-Spanish bases for any operation tied to the Iran conflict. You know why? They want to be able to get their ships through, and they stand for nothing. They spend 1.4% of their military. They think we're going to watch their back. Forget it. Oil experts exports have dropped from 2 million a day, and sanctioned oil, by the way, in Iran, to 1.2. Revenue down from 3 billion to 2 billion as a country, by the way. Inflation, 120%. Currency collapsed. Public workers unpaid, along with the army. Banks have been disrupted. The funds have been frozen in all Gulf state banks. ATMs, they say, are running dry. Besides that, I don't think we're winning. I love these people that go, momentum's on their side, and this is why they feel emboldened. Really? They feel emboldened? By doing what? Yeah, they're definitely putting pain in the world community, cutting down the shortage of energy, no doubt about it. But it's all temporary. The president's going to end that relatively quickly. To me, there's no doubt about that he's going to do that. Some of the people that have stepped forward and said some things is General Jack Keane, obviously. I thought General McKenzie was fantastic over the weekend. Here's what General Keane said last night on Larry Kudlow, Cut 6.
We have been working on this probably ever since they imposed their will. We began executing that war plan. And what does that mean? That means taking down anti-ship missiles at distance, right. Long-range ballistic missiles at distance. Right. The Shahid drones can go almost 1,000 miles, so we're going deep into Iran that can access the Straits of Hormuz, and then we're working close in to deal with what close in? Mine layers, small boats that could be suicide boats to interfere with shipping. They could fire drones from that small boat as well, or fire other kinds of short-range missiles at a boat. Mm. All of that is being exercised.
So, and we just got to find a way. There's a plan in place, and the president's looking at a few options. Do not believe the Wall Street Journal story that said, according to aides, the president's looking to get out and doesn't care what happens to the Strait of Hormuz. That would be something I could never support. I don't think his biggest supporters could support that. I think people that don't want him in this would not even support ending it like that. I mean, I'm talking about Republicans or the podcasting world that's critical of the president. Nobody wants it to end like that. The only people that want it to end like that are the Senator Chris Murphys of the world that want to run for president and say this is an epic fail. The Seth Moultons of the world who say that we're failing. All I can say is at one point you have to look at the facts. I know everything is polarized and political, but just understand what the military is doing. They're taking these this country apart while trying to preserve the lives of the people and lay the groundwork for them to take their country back. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Are you stuck staring at your W-2? Are tax refund worries holding you back? You probably have FOMO, the fear of messing up. The fix? Using TurboTax on Intuit Credit Karma. They find every credit and deduction to help you get every refund dollar you deserve or your money back. It's time to overcome your fear of messing up and get your taxes done right. Start filing today in the Credit Karma app.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan or around the country, around the world. We have a big hour coming your way. We're going to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, simulcast with FBN, and then General Michael Linnington, now CEO of the USO. He's now retired, but a great friend of the show, did a fantastic job with Wounded Warriors for years. With the Pentagon had a press conference today. We had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Kane, as well as Secretary of Defense, now War Hegseth. And they were talking about really how great the mission is going. I'll talk to the general about that, but let's get to the big three.
Number three.
There is only one solution.
Communist revolution.
No King's protest. Yeah, really? Communist revolution? Are you serious? No King's rally shows big numbers and big problems for Dems. What is the message? Communism, socialism, anti-Trumpism? Is that a platform? That's not an agenda for America greatness, is it?
Number two.
We are beyond frustrated at the lack of leadership that's coming out of Congress. Thank God the president enacted an emergency order to ensure the TSA workers are paid, but it's a travesty.
Yes, the TSA finally getting a portion of their pay. Airport stress lowers and lines decrease a bit. But for now, long as Congress, I don't know for how long, as Congress fails to do a deal and is successful in leaving town, fueling bipartisan anger on both of them.
Number one.
The Straits of Hormuz will be open. When this operation is over, it will be open, and it'll be open one way or another. It will be open because Iran agrees to abide by international law and not block the commercial waterway. But we have very clear objectives that we're trying to achieve here.
Operation Epic Fury coming down to the final weeks. What we have left to do and what Iran can do to save itself as our economy wobbles every day the strait stays closed. I don't believe for a second, by the way, that the president's going to leave that strait unopened and just say, okay, we're done. We've hit all our targets. That's not the way it works. I want to get it over with, too. I want the price of oil to go down, but it's not going to go down. So do not believe that Wall Street Journal story. I know a lot of his aides. They say according to his aides. Okay, aides, I don't know what aides they are, but I can't see it because the president wants to win. If he walks away with the strait still closed, that's not winning. In my view. What about yours? Let's bring in a great friend of the show, General Michael Linnington, retired now, CEO of the USO. General, welcome back.
Good to see you, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
So you take big jobs. You know, if you're not running West Point, you're not in war, you are running the Wounded Warriors now with the USO. What is the USO's role when we go to war like this?
Brian, we are the organization that supports our men and women in uniform and their families wherever they go, whenever they deploy. We have 260 locations around the world, every operational theater, every post-camp and station in the United States, 21,000 volunteers, 700 full-time staff. This is exactly what we do, is what's going on now in the Middle East is we have full-time staff, 50 centers all over the Middle East, Africa, and Europe, and we are supporting the warfighter. And I think what you heard this morning from the secretary and the chairman is exactly what our folks overseas revel with, is the opportunity to truly make a difference when America's service members need our support and need the support of the American people.
What's the needs now?
Brian, it's everything. Everything you can imagine. Think of being forward deployed in a remote location. They need connection. They need the comforts of home. They need a place to call home. What's going on right now across especially Europe and the Middle East is unprecedented. But I will tell you, just as the secretary said, and certainly as I pulse our teammates, they're motivated. I mean, nobody likes sitting around doing nothing. This is what we train for. This is why we're forward deployed. And just providing a taste of home, maybe it's a 15-minute break between shifts. Maybe it's, you know, a couple hours in a port if you're on a Navy ship and you're getting resupplied. The USO is there for those sailors, Marines, airmen. Airmen come back from a mission. They want a place to put their feet up, call their spouses, have good Wi-Fi, comfortable chairs, place to get something to eat, replenish their toiletry kit. That's what we do. And we provide those programs and services, not just overseas, but also in the Indo-Pacific and across the United States. And most importantly, Brian, we keep the unit connected to their families back home. That's what's most important.
And General, a lot of our 50,000 troops are on bases, but yet those bases are still targets. Well, how does that affect your job?
Well, CENTCOM and Army Central Command are very careful not to put our troops in harm's way, and they've evacuated us from the most sensitive locations. Now, we leave the USO centers operational with volunteers, usually soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines themselves, and then we resupply the kit they need to keep the center open. They have moved us out of some of the more remote bases in the Middle East that are in missile range, certainly, but we are clearly still all over Europe, the deployment centers, the military hospitals, and the places where service members continue to flow into the region and where family members flow out of the region with the non-combatant evacuation operations which took place a couple weeks ago. The other thing we're doing, Brian, is we have teammates from the continental United States that have reinforced our presence in Europe, Middle East, and Africa. Right now, we have 50 centers in the AOR, 38 staffed, 12 unstaffed. We're on every aircraft carrier, 6 destroyers, And we have staff members here queued up, ready to go over and reinforce if things progress. And you and I mean, I certainly don't know what's going to happen. But should things continue to escalate, then we have the resources to go continue to provide that taste of home and comfort and resilience for our service members to keep them in fighting shape.
And General, when I think of the USO, you think of Bob Hope. Do you guys still an entertainment force?
Brian, we are. In fact, I just went on an entertainment trip not a couple months ago to this very exact region. I mean, the places you and Fox have been covering on the news, I was in many of those locations with an entertainment troupe that went over. Singers, comedians, Vince Wilfork, Super Bowl champion, vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mahoney. I mean, we didn't know this was coming, but just to see the resolve and the resilience and the can-do attitude of our service members that are forward deployed and now reinforcing those deployments with tens of thousands of more forces really have grown those facilities where what the USO provides is even more important.
So, General, were you deployed? I know you were deployed in Afghanistan. Were you in Iraq, too?
I was. 15 months in Iraq and a couple tours in Afghanistan.
So what it must be like when people say 603 Americans died at the hands of EFPs in Iraq, that's Iran-sponsored, Iran-deployed. Iran actually fomented all the unrest there. They caused the insurgency. When people say that this is a war of choice, what do you think?
Brian, that's why I think we need to get this done. Now, this is Mike Lennington, the soldier, speaking. I was in Iraq 2003-04, as you mentioned. The EFPs that arrived in theater in 2005-06 when the surge took place, to see the devastation and the loss of life and equipment from state-sponsored terrorism in Iraq at the time was, I still have those pictures in my mind. So I am certainly supportive of the war fighter, first and foremost, as CEO of the USO. But this is something that's been killing Americans for many, many years, as you know. And later, in 2009-11, when I was in Afghanistan, the same EFPs that were experimented with in Iraq came to Afghanistan as well, as you know.
So I know I was listening to General McKenzie on Face the Nation, and he says over the years in his career, he's seen countless battle plans on what would happen if we ever went to war with Iran or, you know, all of our consistent enemies. How long have you heard about action plans when it came to taking on Iran from different administrations, Brian, different generals?
Brian, I have not been part of those plans. As a colonel, I was focused on the war fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. I was never a CENTCOM planner or an Army planner. I would have loved to have been in the room. I would love to know what the plan is going forward. I'm not privy to that. But what I am privy to is the combatant commands have insisted, and frankly, our partnership with them, unlike any other veteran service or military service organization out there, we have a relationship with the department that allow us to be at these post camps and stations, take care of our wounded warriors coming through Landstuhl, and then ultimately provide support at Dover should those fatalities occur, as they unfortunately have. If things continue to escalate, then the USO has the resources to continue to augment what the department does. And I'm sure the department and the chairman will not bring any of our civilians or volunteers into the theater until it's safe to do so, just as they have evacuated us from the most highest threat areas over the past couple weeks.
General Lennington, lastly, if people want to support this, the USO, which you're the CEO of, it, where do they go?
Brian, I would just ask them to go to our website at uso.org, www.uso.org. Listen, the USO, Brian, at the end of the day, is really America's connection to sons and daughters that are serving our nation. Take the politics out of it. It was founded in 1941. 85 years later, we're still doing the same thing, and it's keeping America connected to our sons and daughters deployed in harm's way, doing our nation's bidding. And that's what I ask people to go to the USO.org, find ways to support our men and women that are forward deployed through the programs and services the USO provides.
Got it. Lieutenant General Michael Lennington, thanks so much, General.
Thanks for having me on, Brian.
You got it. So, as I mentioned on Face the Nation on Sunday, usually when the networks book somebody, it's so as to run down whatever the Republicans are doing. I mean, they might have a Republican on. Most of them are anti-Trump Republicans, like Don Bacon or Senator Tillis, who is somewhat fair, but obviously he's leaving because he got in the crossways with President Trump. That was one of the reasons. But that's kind of bad because he would have won that seat again. And I know right now Michael Whatley is doing a good job, but right now he's trailing to Governor Cooper, who wants to be Senator Cooper. So I want you to hear what General McKenzie said, because he was chairman of the he was over at CENTCOM for a while. And this is what he said. Listen.
This is part of a plan that's been in existence for many years. What we're doing right now is we're reducing Iranian ability to target ships in the Strait through their short-range missiles, their drones, and other activities. We do that by maintaining air superiority over southern Iran on a 24/7 basis, looking for where these missiles are and striking them relentlessly. Once we reduce those to a very low level, then you'll be able to go in, if necessary, sweep for mines. I'm not certain they put mines in the water yet. I predict eventually they will. It's their nature. But we have the ability to do this. We're on plan. I'll be honest with you, Margaret. I've simulated this many years in many positions at Central Command. We're a little further along than we would have expected to be at this point in all the simulations that I've seen.
So that's General McKenzie, who famously was in charge of Afghanistan when it fell apart. And he got a call from the Taliban commander outside Kabul and said, everybody has left. Do you want me to go in to get Kabul and take it? Or do you want me to stay on the outside? And McKenzie said, all we want is the airport. That, I don't think, was the best decision. But since that time, I expect when they go to him, he was just going to run down the next administration who was so critical of his operation. And he hasn't. Because I think he's not only cheering for our success, he's also noticing our success. He does not need to see a satellite photo. He picks up the phone. He probably knows every commander right now in charge. And he knows exactly what's going on. Now, it's tough for the average American because we're not getting a lot of reporters on the ground in Tehran. I got some GBN reporters. I was looking at BBC might have somebody. But for the most part, they're not really reporting openly and freely. The country's being destroyed. Yeah. So with their command structure being destroyed. Right now, they're extremely unorganized, which for the most part's good. But the bad part is it's hard to organize any type of peace talks or ceasefire talks. 18 ships in the Middle East have been attacked. That's enough to keep the strait closed. We've got to fix that. 3,000 vessels are waiting to pass through the strait. That's a whole lot of oil, natural gas, and fertilizer. When we come back, I'll be taking your calls. Bottom of the hour, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All right, welcome back, everybody. So I had a chance to talk to the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, and J.P. Morgan is probably the most successful financial company in the country, $4.4 trillion worth of assets. They're doing a ton of work, too, for rebuilding and rebuilding the American dream. It's a very hardcore money-based initiative to give people an opportunity that maybe feel like that dream is slipping away. One thing I did talk to him about, other things, one of which is in New York, trying to raise taxes, and they're doing it again. There's a big movement now, evidently in Albany. Everybody's for raising the corporate rate from 7.5 to 9%. And Apollo, which is this huge investment firm, says, we're going to be leaving. We're looking for a place over in Florida. Like, when they're going to learn, I don't know. But I asked him about Governor Hochul, who came out originally and said, hey, if you guys don't want to pay our taxes and be part of it, good riddance, go to Florida. She has a totally different take. And I played that take. Now she says, do your patriotic duty, come back from Palm Beach and come into New York. Here's what Jamie Dimon told us.
A good politician should realize that you need a competitive state to build and grow businesses. And you've seen, if you look at it, Texas is growing, Florida is growing. They like business. They have incentive systems and taxes that bring in business, and it helps all the citizens of those states. You know, and that's the biggest mistake, that somehow punishing business is going to help lower-income people. It doesn't. And you've seen people leave, and people vote with their feet. It is a free country. They have the right to do it. They're not immoral. because they say, I worked hard for my money. I want to pass more of it on to my kids. And we have to be very careful to act like you're immoral because you want to do that.
You got to give an incentive. So I was stunned to see there's this huge building in New York City. It's going to be a flag. It's going to be as important as the Empire State Building. I really mean that. And you got to see this thing to understand it. I mean, it's got stone. It looks like it's its own city. And he's so proud of it. He was there every day. He was talked about inviting everybody who worked on the building. And he invited them up on the all to the 57th floor. And they had 2,000 people and their kids. And I guess a portion didn't come, but 2,000 up there and their kids afterwards. And he talked about everything that involved in building in the city. They got construction workers jobs. They got union jobs. Then they have to bring more people in. They hired more people. Think about everything that's happened, the parking. By building that building, everybody benefited. And ultimately, he feels as though his company absolutely needed it. But he invested in it. At the same time, he's got more people in Dallas. Because Dallas is a better place to live. More people want to live there. So don't think that he'll stay. J.P. Morgan will stay. But they're not going to continue to build in a state that says there shouldn't have, has a mayor that says billionaires shouldn't be allowed. Well, he's a multi-billionaire. You know how much he made when he first came out of college? $22,000. His dad was a stockbroker. Didn't know anybody. So that's what you could have. Not everyone could be CEO of a major financial firm, but whatever year it is. And that's why he's doing his initiative. And when it comes to Kathy Hochul, don't just say come back. What is the financial reason to come back?
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I don't know that there's any evidence that this new iteration of the Iranian regime is any more reasonable than the last one. The new Supreme Leader, whom we haven't seen publicly at least, and is reportedly was seriously injured, is certainly given no indication that he's interested in negotiations. Iran has refused or rejected publicly the idea of coming to the negotiating table in good faith and discussing the key issues which led to this war, which is their ballistic missile program, their nuclear program, and their support to proxy terrorists in the region. And so the president is delivering this pretty serious threat, and we'll have to see how Iran responds.
Evidently, there's a public Iran and there's a private Iran. And now we have new faces. 250 are eliminated. Means they're dead. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West joins us now. Dallas County Republican Party chair, American Constitutional Rights Union executive director, former congressman in Florida. Colonel, what's your take on where we're at right now? And how do you feel about what Dan Hoffman said, that the new guys are just as bad as the old guys?
Yeah, I have to agree with that. I mean, you can't make a deal with the devil, and I don't care how many devils you kill, they're still all devils. I think the most important strategic imperatives that are facing President Trump and the War Department right now, get the Straits of Hormuz open. We cannot have that choke point. We cannot have Iran being able to hold up the flow and the supply of oil to the rest of the world. We have to make sure that, again, they are not able to do, as you see, support these Islamic terrorist organizations, to include the Houthis now, who jumped in over the weekend, and they're threatening the straits there at Bab al-Mandab, which is another global choke point for shipping. And I think the other thing that we have to do is economically hurt them. Now, as far as attacking, desalination plants and things of this nature, I don't want to see us turn the people of Iran against us and then, bring about that suffering. But without a doubt, we need to defang the tiger and make sure that there's a toothless tiger going forward.
And that strait's got to be open and we can't leave. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. It has to be open because, who's going to do it? I mean, what was the point of going in? You can say, yeah, we reduced their ballistic missile capability and threat. Maybe we took out their ICBM threat, their Navy, their Air Force. But the bottom line is we cannot have Iran and its proxy militaries like the Houthis still in charge of two very important global shipping choke points.
So when you look at how this is going, did you see the Pentagon press conference today?
No, I was in the airplane flying back here to Dallas, so I missed it.
So basically, they feel like they're on target. Listen, I want you to hear what General McKenzie said And he's somebody who has no reason to do anything but call it like he sees it. So this guy, he was on Face the Nation this weekend. As people know, he was head of CENTCOM. Let's listen.
This is part of a plan that's been in existence for many years. What we're doing right now is we're reducing Iranian ability to target ships in the strait through their short-range missiles, their drones, and other activities. We do that by maintaining air superiority over southern Iran on a 24/7 basis, looking for where these missiles are and striking them relentlessly. Once we reduce those to a very low level, then you'll be able to go in, if necessary, sweep for mines. I'm not certain they put mines in the water yet. I predict eventually they will. It's their nature. But we have the ability to do this. We're on plan. I'll be honest with you, Margaret. I've simulated this many years in many positions at Central Command. We're a little further along than we would have expected to be at this point in all the simulations that I've seen.
You believe him?
Yeah, I do believe him. I mean, he's a former CENTCOM commander. He's speaking from experience. And look, going back to 1997, when I was stationed at Fort Bragg, we ran a simulation exercise with the 82nd, who I was a part of supporting, going into Bandar Abbas there in the Strait of Hormuz. So all of these things have been war games simulated and planned out for years. And so I believe that, yes, without a doubt, we're just, 5 weeks into this? We have achieved incredible results in just 5 weeks. And so now you've got to get that strait open. You got to make sure, because you do have that air dominance to take out those missile systems. And we have the Navy minesweepers. They can go in there and make sure that those mines, if they are there, they will be eliminated and taken out. And we have that capability and capacity. So again, I think that right now, you know, the regime change and all this type of stuff, not as important as getting the Straits of Hormuz open and economically crippling Iran and making sure that they cannot be a threat by way of these terrorist organizations or their ballistic missile capabilities.
So among our allies that are just MIA, it's Spain, nobody worse. They won't even spend 2% of their military, not even trying. And then they say, we're not allowed to use their airs. We're not allowed to use our own bases, and we're not allowed to even fly over their airspace. Listen to the Secretary of State on Al Jazeera, cut four.
We have countries like Spain, a NATO member that we are pledged to defend, denying us the use of their airspace and bragging about it, denying us the use of their bases. And there are other countries that have done that as well. And so you ask yourself, well, what is in it for the United States? And I've been a big supporter of NATO. And one of the reasons why I've been a supporter of NATO is because I believe that these basing rights give us leverage and give us flexibility and operational capability all over the world. But if NATO is just about us defending Europe if they're attacked, but them denying us basing rights when we need them, that's not a very good arrangement. That's a hard one to stay engaged in and say this is good for the United States. So all of them's going to have to be reexamined. All of it's going to have to be reexamined.
And I think you have to say, you know what, if Spain's in, then we're out.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things you have to look at is a lot of these Western European countries, they have fallen prey to the internal Islamic jihadist threat that they have because they allowed their open borders in this cold, you know, feint of multiculturalism to overtake them. And that's become a huge consideration. But for them to say that as a member of NATO, they're going to deny another NATO member the overflight, that's unacceptable. And so I would say that we start looking at where we can shift those bases and take them to someplace else, those naval bases and air bases as well. So this is a huge challenge for us in our ongoing relationship with NATO, because guess what? A lot of that oil that comes out of the Straits of Hormuz, it goes to Europe. It doesn't come to the United States of America.
Right, and they want to get their discount, and they want to be able to get their oil out, so their relationship with Iran is more valuable to them than their relationship with us. Pretty short-term thinking, I would say. Lastly, you were in an airport. How long did you wait to get on and off?
It was very easy. I tell you what, you know, we have never had any problems here at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport or Dallas Love Field. Hats off to the TSA agents here. I know there's been some issues down in Houston, but things are going very well. No ICE agents at the airports that I was at in Fort Lauderdale Airport this morning at 0:30 when I was there. Things flowed very smoothly. So, again, thank you to those Americans of the Transportation Security Agency. And shame on these elected officials who, you know, go around, you know, affecting the paychecks of other Americans while they still get paid. That's not leadership.
I don't think it is either. And lastly, DHS, as you know, is out. Chris Coons was said, why did you guys leave? And listen to how he ends his interview. Cut 15.
How do you justify being off for the next 2 weeks? We're 45 days in. Can Democrats and Republicans keep affording to play this blame game?
You know well that we're not off. We're working every day in our home states. For most of us, this is when we have the time to go up and down our state and to meet with our constituents
but
and listen to their concerns.
But people aren't getting paid, sir. So
ma'am,
don't you owe,
let me finish,
don't you owe it
my
to
answer.
Them?
Thank
to
you all very much.
Great. Really?
Yeah. I think they saw, they were showing pictures of Lindsey Graham down at Disneyland or Disney World, something like that. I don't know. But I doubt these guys are doing a whole lot of work up there. But again, they're still getting paid and they're members of the federal government who are supposed to be keeping us safe that are not getting paid. And I think that the American people would prioritize those Americans like the TSA agents who are doing yeoman's work to keep us safe and secure in the airways over some of these members of the Senate.
All right. And lastly, when it comes to this Senate race, Cornyn and Ken Paxton, it looks like a flat-footed tie right now.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. And, the ads are quite disturbing. I wish that people would just talk about policy and what they want to do instead of, being like two gunboats out in the middle of the ocean shooting back and forth at each other. I think that the edge will end up going to Ken Paxton in the end.
All right. Thanks so much, Colonel Alan West. Appreciate
it. My pleasure.
All right. I do want to finish off what we were just discussing, and that is that Congress left town. Whether you think the House was right or the Senate was right, I would think they should come back and work it out. But the President of the United States had to go cut a check from some other area in order to pay the TSA and some of their back pay. Here's Dasha Burns of Politico. Cut 19.
You know, the president decided to issue this executive order to pay TSA agents. I said, how long can the White House keep doing that? I mean, there can't be an indefinite amount of funds to do this. And she said the president can't just keep signing memorandums time and time again when Congress fails to do their jobs. But that was the pain point. The airports were the thing that was pushing both sides to talk to one another. Now, I mean, I just really struggle, and my sources that I talk to struggle to see how this gets resolved.
Yeah, I hear you too. Because, look, it's the Democrats who feel they're getting something out of standing up against ICE. And the Republicans say, are you kidding me? We got hired to enforce the border and to get illegal immigrant criminals out of this country. We're not giving either. And with the president writing the checks, I think Dasha Burns might be right. When we come back, Stuart Varney joins us, and we join him. Brian Kilmeade Show.
The Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. In a little while, we're going to be joined by Stuart Varney. We'll do a simulcast on FBN. But talking politics, I think it's kind of interesting, and I'll play it when we're done with the hit, about what's happening in Michigan. In Michigan, you're looking at Mike Rogers, who is favored to maybe flip that seat over there. But some of the Democratic candidates are from Dearborn, and it turns out some commentary, audio has emerged showing that these guys are sympathetic to the Ayatollah, but they can't act like it if they want to get elected. I'm going to play some of that clip when we get back in Michigan. But it should be disqualifying.
A CNN commentator is throwing shade on Governor Gavin Newsom. Watch this.
I don't like Gavin Newsom. I think the Democrats are wrong to wrap their arms around Gavin Newsom. I don't think another California coastal liberal is the savior of their party. I think Gavin Newsom's made a ton of mistakes. And I don't think California, as economically important as it is, should be a sort of model for how our states should run.
Well, Brian, has the left abandoned Newsom?
Well, not yet. I mean, he's winning in almost all the polls because he's telegenic, perhaps, and he likes to fight Trump. But if the problem with Gavin Newsom is not me, it's not you, it's the back of his baseball card. You know what's on the back of people's baseball cards? Their stats. Their stats are terrible. Homelessness is through the roof. Their GDP is down. Gas is always at least $1.75 more. He has gotten rid of every refinery except one. He stopped offshore drilling. What he also saw is taxes rise through the roof and the huge exodus of his income base, of his tax base, because he's raised taxes so much and people have gotten so little. If I'm running against Gavin Newsom, it's such a target-rich environment. How can he possibly win? Because all you have to do is, you're Governor Shapiro, you're Governor Beshear, you're Mayor Pete. You can't go against Gavin Newsom and not bring up what a terrible mayor and governor he's been.
I think he's got trouble. Next one, Brian. The American Action Network launching a $10 million ad blitz to spotlight Trump's tax cuts. And Speaker Mike Johnson said this on your show earlier today.
The Working Families Tax Cut was written for lower and middle class earners, for the people who get up and start working before the sun rises and goes home after it sets to feed their families. Everybody who works in a tip job, they pay zero taxes now, Lawrence, on the first $25,000 of their tipped income. For the average American that does those jobs, that's about $1,300 more in their pocket. You're talking about millions of Americans. I mean, here in New York, 500,000 people worked in tip jobs. Every Republican in Congress voted for that, and every Democrat voted against it.
All right, Brian, is this going to work for the GOP and for President Trump in the midterms?
Well, I mean, it's going to help. It would be, you know, when the war's over, it's really going to help. But they're right to do it, because how many people, Stuart, come up to me and you and say, more you because your business, what's in the big, beautiful bill? Tax on tits, what else? What they did is they took everything, their whole agenda, and put it in one. And that's why people say, well, they only had one big piece of legislation. Well, normally it would be four or five, or at the least two. But they said, we got one shot at this through reconciliation. Let's put it all in. Boom, it's done. Next thing you know, we have a budget impasse. We don't have a chance to really understand what's in it. We don't have a chance to really feel anything from it, because it's not really into kick into 2026, at which time we finally get back to work. We feel the repercussions of the GDP hit after the 45-day lockout. And now what are we in the middle of? Another, and then we have a war on top of that. This is something that is really pro-growth. I had Jamie Dimon on the radio show and on TV today, and he said this administration, with between cutting regulation and the big, beautiful bill, has really primed the pump extremely well and made a lot of good decisions. And I think that when the war is over, which should probably be a couple of weeks, we're going to start to see things really kick into gear. But they're right to push back and put some positive news out there, because you're not going to get it from the networks.
No, you're definitely not going to get it from the networks, and that's a fact. I'm afraid I'm out of time, but that was all good stuff today. Thanks so much, Brian Kilmeade. Get back to your radio show. We'll see you again soon.
I will. And I want to go. Remember what I was talking to you right before we went to Stewart and did the simulcast? And that's what's happened politically over in Michigan. So this is some of, this guy's name is Abdul El Sayed. So this is a public, this is a statement that was leaked out, he says, by somebody in his camp who didn't like him. So he's the Michigan Democratic Senate candidate. He hasn't got the nomination yet. Mike Reid has got the nomination. And it's not even a formality. It's done. On the Democratic side, they want someone to run. Gary Peters. This is the Gary Peters seat. So it's open. So listen to what he says about the Iran war and the death of Ayatollah. Cut 12.
I also want to remind you guys that there are a lot of people in Dearborn who are sad today. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So, like, I just don't want to comment on Khamenei at all. Like, yeah. I don't think it's worth even touching that. Like, they're going to try. This is what we practice. But, like, isn't Khamenei a bad guy? Isn't it great that he's dead? Well, my first man was 86 years old. He was going to be dead sometime soon anyway. Second, that doesn't justify, the fact that he was a bad man does not justify our breaking of international law and unilateral action outside of wartime. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a bigger question about the United States' responsibility to international law, and we have been breaking it wantonly. This is the second leader that mm-hmm. we've gone after in a matter of months. We are not the world's policeman, and that's not what he got elected to do.
So you have to worry about the people that voted for you are pro-Grand Ayatollah, Supreme Leader. If you're going to vote for me and you're a fan of them or communism, I go, no, keep it. No problem. I don't want to get elected. If I need to service your needs as somebody who is pro-extremist and pro-terrorist, you could keep your vote. I'll lose. But this guy is upset that this got out, and he's upset that we wrote a story about it and have talked about it. Not that he thinks that way and the people that he's trying to elicit votes from feel that way. This guy's killed 600 and something Americans. He played a key role when Khomeini was alive. He was his chief of staff when 241 Marines were died, let alone the financing of October 7th. And Hezbollah, how many people has Hezbollah killed? That's them. And that's him. Hey, hope to see you in Reno May 30th. Go to BrianKilmeade.com and get some tickets. Also, I'll be July 11th in Pensacola, Florida. I hope to see you there in person. History, Liberty, and Laughs. We bring history to life in a fun, entertaining, insightful way. Streamed on Fox Nation.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. The Brian Kilmeade Show coming forward. Rachel Campos-Duffy at the bottom of the hour. She's going to be joining us in studio. She's filling in for Ainsley this week, I think tomorrow, too. And, of course, we'll take your calls. And don't forget to check out, go to my website, BrianKilmeade.com. Hopefully, I'll be in the city right near you shortly because I have a book coming out in October called Uniting the States. And I'm changing the tour entirely in the fall, but I'm going to start breaking up the show a little bit and revealing some of the new stage show in May 30th in Reno and then July 11th in Pensacola, Florida, the Pensacola Singer Theater. Then coming up on October 16th in Red Bank, New Jersey, October 17th, Westbury, New York, and Clearwater, Florida, November 7th, November 8th in Jacksonville, Florida, and Chesterfield, Missouri, right in St. Louis, November 21st. Just go to BrianKilmeade.com for details. So before we get to our first guest, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
There is only one solution.
Communist revolution.
Communist revolution.
Yeah, I don't know. Yep, there you go. No King's Rally shows big numbers and big problems for Dems. What's the message? What's their message? So it's communism, socialism, anti-Trumpism? That's not an agenda for American greatness, is it?
Number two.
We are beyond frustrated at the lack of leadership that's coming out of Congress. Thank God the president enacted an emergency order to ensure the TSA workers are paid, but it's a travesty.
It is a travesty, and that is Ed Bastian, the CEO of Delta. TSA finally getting a portion of their pay. Airport stress lowers and lines decrease a bit. But for now, and how long, as Congress fails to do a deal and is successful in leaving town, fueling bipartisan anger.
Number one.
The Straits of Hormuz will be open. When this operation is over, it will be open, and it'll be open one way or another. It will be open because Iran agrees to abide by international law and not block the commercial waterway. But we have very clear objectives that we're trying to achieve here.
Marco Rubio on Al Jazeera, Operation Epic Fury, coming down to its final weeks. What we have left to do and what Iran can do to save itself as our economy wobbles every day the Strait stays closed. And with us right now is Benham Ben Talibu. Talibu, the FDD Senior Iran Program Director. Benham, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me again.
So I think that we're having some trouble finding out who to deal with Iran, because we have a president reportedly arguing with the NRGC commander about direction going forward. If that's happening, how are we going to know who to sit down with?
You know, this is going to be a challenge moving forward, because what's left of this regime is what I like to call a zombie regime. It really is headless. There's multiple centers of power and kind of like the arms of a zombie. They flail. They still do damage. They're uncoordinated. They all have a plan, but sometimes the best of plans doesn't really materialize when the rubber hits the road here. So there's a lot of personalist fighting. There's a lot of individual motivation. And actually, that offers America more room, not for diplomacy, but to press on the fissures and press on the cleavages of this system to actually make sure that we can get something akin to surrender. Because if we simply throw them a lifeline and talk to this faction versus that faction, they're going to run circles around us just like they've done against multiple administrations in the past.
So a couple of things are happening. The MEK is saying, let us in, let us fight. And evidently, the Kurds are saying they're open to fighting. What role should we have in financing or supporting them?
With immense respect, none. I mean, if Washington wants to deal with the opposition, it should deal with the one that is actually the most pro-U.S., the most pro-Israeli, and actually has the most legitimacy inside Iran. And that's the followers of exiled Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi. These are people who have turned out in the millions abroad. the only person like President Trump who can draw these crowds is exiled Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi. Inside Iran, they went out under bullets and chanted his name. I don't think when it comes to, you know, sending in the MEK, sending in a bunch of veterans of former conflicts, that'll be able to really do much. And with respect to the Kurds, they have fought bravely as a U.S. partner in the region in places like Iraq and Syria. But if you want to keep the large swath of anti-regime and pro-American Iranians on your side, the way you do that is not to signal that your country is going to potentially become like the Balkans or like Yugoslavia, which unfortunately some of these Kurdish groups do have different aspirations for when it comes to autonomy or even potentially independence.
So what do you think is happening on the ground right now in Tehran, in the capital and other surrounding suburbs?
So I think in major urban centers, and again, based on what we're hearing on landlines, because the internet is still shut down for over a month, so it's hard to get a consistent stream of pictures and video and whatnot coming out of that country. But Iranians are actually proving that the main concern, the main actual sentiment, the main emotion is anger. It's not fear. You know, people have said that since January 8th, January 9th, since the mass crackdown of protesters, that everybody in Iran is afraid of the regime. They do have fears about the regime, but they're more angry with the regime than anything else. And they're simply waiting for the fog of war to dissipate to be able to show that anger again. So no one likes living in a war zone. Those are sentiments you hear not just from Tehran, but really a big spread of urban and even semi-urban centers. But they're really hoping that America does stay the course here. And there's no sort of premature victory lap that locks in, again, this zombie system.
The besiege, that's the plainclothes motorcycle riding thugs that enforcers for this government. How many are left? Are they still a presence?
They are a significant presence. And this besiege, you know, you just hit the nail right on the head there, sir, because while this regime is busy losing a war to America and to Israel abroad, at home, it is still trying to signal to the vast swaths of unarmed Iranians who still oppose the regime. It is trying to signal that the main enemy is actually the Iranian people. And that's why at nights, in many of these major urban centers, the besieged paramilitary, which number in the hundreds of thousands, continue to turn out, wheel chains, clubs, chant pro-regime slogans in a bid to intimidate the population to make sure that once the conflict stops, that the protests don't start again. And that's why it's imperative for actually the Israelis to be given more time to continue their mission, because the Israelis have been taking out large numbers of these besieged where they gather. And that's not just their barracks or compounds, but even once those facilities are bombed, the besieged will set up tents in parks, in the streets, in soccer fields. And then, the Israelis will strafe those positions. And, you know, it's very interesting that those are some of the most applauded strikes by the Iranian population, which are the ones that strafe the besieged positions and hit the armored personnel carriers that are hiding under bridges and tunnels and setting up checkpoints, intimidating the population.
So I don't know if you're the right person to talk to, but it seems like in these day of cyber hits and cyber hacks, there might be a way, I thought, for some of our geniuses to get that internet on. I know Starlink, they found a way to thwart that and you need a receiver. But what about the internet? I mean, we've already put a virus into one of their programs before that was revealed during the George Bush years. I mean, do you think we have people working on this?
We certainly do, but we certainly should have more. You know, there's opportunities legislatively and from a regulatory perspective to make sure that we have everything that we need to get direct to cell technologies into Iran. You know, you mentioned Starlink, where you need a physical receiver. Iran does have a lot of smuggled newer smartphones, particularly iPhones. To be able to get direct to cell technology on those phones, either based on the software and the hardware, simply requires changing things legislatively and from a regulatory perspective, so that instead of needing that physical receiver, your smartphone device could be basically in contact with a satellite that is in low Earth orbit. That's something America and Europe can do, again, from a legislative perspective and from a regulatory perspective. It'll be small scale, but if that small scale works, it could be scaled up. And also, when it comes to Starlinks, I think the answer is going to be, if the regime is able to confiscate them, it's to win the fight just like the West won the fight with respect to satellite dishes in the 1990s and 2000s. There was such a low cost and persistent high supply and high demand that the regime couldn't keep up and couldn't keep confiscating satellite dishes, which is why sometimes you see two or three outside of an apartment or a house in a single household. You know, the regime lost that fight, and it's critical to make sure that they lose this fight as well. And by the way, I have to say, in a period of time when the regime has shut down the internet, the actual internet that connects Iranians to the World Wide Web outside the country, and they are doubling down on this thing called the intranet, which is the national internet for the country that doesn't really go out of the country's borders. Those targets that are actually doing their repression, their surveillance, creating that digital firewall, those could be easy targets for the U.S. and the Israelis militarily to strike, to say if the Iranian people can't have internet, no one can have internet.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable that the foreign minister was able to say they don't need the internet, I have it, essentially. Really? So the foreign minister has it to speak for them. Benham, why are we seeing them on television? Like, why do they still have a national TV channel?
Again, you just hit the nail right on the head there. Not just these folks, but a host of other regime, political elite, military elite, continue to benefit, again, from the internet to get their message abroad using international media. You know, this is an own goal of epic proportions for us to turn a blind eye, whether it's on social media or traditional media, to the regime's use and abuse of these platforms to get their anti-American, anti-Israeli hatred and invective into our societies, into our national debates, but really continue to filter and firewall and cordon off the internet for when it comes to large swaths of their own people. It can't be what's good for me is not good for thee.
I would think so. So when people say that advantage, as the Economist did, advantage Iran, or they're emboldened, do you subscribe to that?
They are certainly emboldened, but let me tell you this phrase in Persian, which is I'm hearing it a lot now, and it's called wind is moving beneath the double chin, and it's basically designed to talk about hubris or largesse, someone who's developed a double chin, and you know they're just enjoying the wind flicking it back and forward. Forgive the imagery, but it's someone who is so foolish, so hubristic that they will make mistakes. And in this case, that defines the IRGC. They think they're winning. There's a narrative of victory, but they haven't seen exactly the damage that has been wrought against the entire regime, against the missile, military, and other capabilities, against the security forces. Once the fog of war dissipates, if anything is left of this regime, it'll see how much of a national security rump state it actually is. And that will actually create more, not less, opportunities for America to press its advantage.
Ben Talablu is with us now. He's a senior Iran program director. So the question is, if this, we get the Strait open and we find some way to land this plane in the next 2 weeks, what's going to stop China from building it up again and Russia from building it up again when they are able to and they're not able to now? And I think there could be leverage here. And the leverage could be the Gulf states. The Gulf states, China and Russia want to do business with the Gulf states. So Saudi Arabia has got to make it clear, you do business with Iran, not with us. UAE, not with us. Oman, not with us. And I would hope Egypt and others would feel the same way, because they understand that Iran is the enemy of the region beyond Shia or Sunni. Do you think that that would get their attention?
It certainly is worth trying, and I think it certainly should be tried. You know, many of these states have a lot of economic leverage because over the past 20 years, their major trade partner hasn't been the United States. It's actually been China. And there is a real lesson to be learned here about the many years of hedging we've seen from Saudi Arabia and from the UAE and some of these other actors in the Persian Gulf, where they try to pay to play or pay to delay. They try to limp along and live alongside the Islamic Republic because there are fears of escalation, fears of the neighbor firing missiles and drones. Well, guess what? The neighbor is firing missiles and drones. And if that country's major export is oil, and if the biggest licit and illicit importer of Iranian oil since 2011, 2012 has been China, well, then connect the dots. China is the major underwriter for that missile, military, drone threat that these countries have suffered from. And Iran is not just at war with America or Israel right now. Iran is at war with the heartland of the Arab world right now. And it would be a real mistake for these countries not to pool their leverage and resources together and to put China to the choice. And, you know, China has always sold Iran out at the right price, sold the Islamic Republic out at the right price. Why not take this opportunity to build a better order, to be able to contain and militarily roll back, economically roll back what's left of this regime? And why not have our partners help to do that?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm tired of us doing it just ourselves. We sanction them. We enforce. I would love Saudi Arabia and UAE are asking us to finish the job. Oman, these other countries are asking us to finish the job. Qatar is saying finish the job. So the one thing we ask of them when the job's finished, so we don't have to go back, band together and send China and Russia a message. You can't have it both ways. And I think that they've showed us a lot already by standing strong and not criticizing the American effort, because I think they see what we're doing. Bannon?
Amen.
Yeah.
There's a huge role to play. Amen. Let me just say one thing. The UAE has been a major artery during Trump term one for economic sanctions busting. There's a whole host of front companies and affiliates and money laundering that goes on there. You know, the UAE has talked about clamping down on those illicit Iranian fronts and businesses. I would love to see that come to fruition, to be able to not let the Islamic Republic exploit the friendly jurisdiction, the pro-American jurisdiction, that is the UAE after this conflict ends. And the way they do that is to seize those accounts, seize those assets, and make sure that the regime doesn't use an economy like the UAE's that is connected to the world, that is connected to the West, to be able to breathe and get around Trump's sanctions.
Well, you just told me something I didn't know. I did not know the UAE was helping Iran get around our sanctions. Ben, I hope they're up. They seem to be their eyes wide open now. More rockets drones have gone into UAE than Israel. So that says something. They don't like any sense of freedom in the Islamic world, especially. Ben, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Always enjoy
your
insight.
Thank you.
All right, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, we'll squeeze in some calls. Bottom of the hour, Rachel Campos, Duffy. So this is your opportunity. Don't move.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
That they're players on the court, but some of the coaches say they're just doing their job.
Now we're supposed to just hug and kiss everybody. You know what? Do your job right. Go to class and you won't hear about not going to class. The truth that you think any coach in America would be yelling at a guy because he did it wrong once or twice or five times or 10 times. You have no idea what coaching's all about.
You know, society, you know, we've gotten soft in a lot of ways. I think young people, the teachers and coaches that impact their lives the most are not the teachers and coaches that, like, gave them a grade they didn't deserve. I mean, you remember the teachers and coaches that pushed you.
When you allow your children to grow up, it is a direct reflection of your parenting. Direct. Like, if you hover over them all the time and they can't work through problems, they're going to have some issues.
So that is part of some of the controversy, which I don't think is controversy, but we watched Danny Hurley get really tough with players. We watched female coaches get in touch with their players. And the players are not complaining. But at home, people are saying, well, they're being too mean. They're yelling too much. They're getting in their face. And the players, I saw that one woman who was walking off the court and got screamed at right in her face. At the end, she nodded her head and walked away. And she goes, I told the coach when you recruited me, I want you to coach me hard. She is the best player on the team. And I'm fine with it. I remember that Danny Hurley's dad, Bob Hurley, was at St. Anthony's. I watched the game that he had in the Garden. And I just said to one of the coaches that I was watching the game with, man, he's yelling at those kids constantly. He says a lot of them, they need it. They need to have some discipline in their lives. Sometimes it's the first discipline they ever got. And that's just part of it.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
That call for communism is part of this global warfare on the United States, sowing chaos as we've seen for decades now. That's really been crystallized over the last few years. And it is part of this vast network that I've identified at about 500 organizations that were behind the no King's protest on Saturday.
So that's Ashran Omani, a Fox News digital reporter, does a great job. $500 billion worth of financing involved, a lot of it foreign money, into the No Kings rally. And there were communism flags, socialism flags, let alone the anti-ICE, anti-American. Sure, I expected the anti-Trump stuff. But the No Kings rally, the whole premise is asinine. You got to be kidding me. This guy's a king, and he can't get TSA funded. This guy's a king, and he has the Supreme Court overturn his tariff policy. This guy's a king and can't get a birthright citizenship done. He's the worst king ever. In fact, if you're hiring for a king, Trump would never get the job. But somebody that was at the No Kings rally protesting, using foreign money to finance her trip, is Rachel Campos Duffy. Rachel, how much money did you take from communists in order to protest with Robert De Niro over the weekend?
It's amazing, isn't it?
How much money the communists have?
I mean, they've got billions.
It's amazing.
It's billions to create instability and lie. And you're right. Trump would be the worst king.
Right.
Every executive order he makes or every decision he makes, the Democrats overturn it or find some way to get some judge to interfere with it. You're absolutely right.
Right. So it makes absolutely no sense. And I think when Tony Blair came out and he said, the Democratic Party has to disassociate itself from radical Islam. If you told me that 10 years ago, I'd go, of course, no kidding. It's like saying, you got to do the best you can to disassociate yourself from raging criminals or death row inmates.
Right.
Okay, no kidding. But there is a bond. It's in England, too.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. And we talked about this a little bit on the show today. I mean, Muslims have to do a better job of policing their own religion.
We've been asking them since 9/11 to do that.
I know, but you and I both know they exist, right? Moderate Muslims exist. You and I know them. They live nice, quiet lives. They, participate in politics. But for some reason, they don't police their own, and that it really is on them at some point, because it's just so obvious that they have a problem inside of Dearborn.
The head coach of the Titans is Muslim. So, I mean, we know Zuda Jassy. I forgot his name. He's actually running for Congress over in Texas. But here's more from Ashran Omani, who's doing the investigative reporting on this. Here's Cut 24.
I was shocked. On Saturday, I was in Minnesota at the state capitol at this protest, and there, right off stage, they were selling the Communist Manifesto. I know it's hard to believe, but there at the state capitol of Minnesota, off stage at the No Kings rally, was a Communist Manifesto. And then a socialist reconstruction of America.
I mean, you bring the Communist Manifesto, the 1847 book from Karl Marx, and you think, well, that's going to get me some traction. Really?
Yeah. Well, by the way, that's the number one most required book in all of higher education. Not the Constitution, not the Federalist Papers.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we should all study the Communist Manifesto as a cautionary tale of.
Look, yeah, Adam Smith and Karl Marx, compare them. Pick one. Well, the world did pick one. And guess what failed epically?
Absolutely. And in real time, you don't have to go back and look at, the fall of the Soviet Union or all the death that it caused in the 20th century. You can just look right at Cuba, 90 miles off our shore. You can look right at Venezuela, what it did to the most resource-rich country in the hemisphere.
Right. So if you are a Democrat, you want to use momentum to take back the way the Tea Party did. When Barack Obama comes out, I think 63 seats flipped after the first 2 years. They didn't like the way he was doing things.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily dislike him. He's a very talented guy, very conversational. Mm-hmm. Nobody doubts his intellect. People didn't like the way he was leading. Okay. So if you're a Democrat, what's your message? Don't like Trump, like socialism, like communism, don't have a problem with Islamic extremism. Where's the idea there? Like, what are you going to do different? Rahm Emanuel, for example, I don't think he fits the bill in any of those things. What's he doing?
I do think that there, the congressman out of Silicon Valley, what's his name? Ro Khanna. Ro Khanna, to me, is a model of somebody that, if that message, I think, could work for them, right? It's the problem is there's a big difference between Ro Khanna and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ilhan Omar, and the energy in their party is there. The other candidate, by the way, for president that I think everyone should pay attention to, because I think he's a sleeper candidate. I mean, he's definitely on the list, but not high up. But I think he is formidable, and that is Josh Shapiro. Josh Shapiro, so every time I hear him, and by the way, I know he's a complete radical in the state because I know people who live there who can't believe just what a radical
school choice. He said he was going to do that. Doesn't
yeah, do and he's in, on abortion, radical, radical pro-abort. However, when you hear him talk, you kind of like him. And that's See, part of it, too.
I find when I watched him with Bill Maher, and I felt Bill Maher was frustrated, too. It was like, come out of it. You're into the rhetoric, like the rote. You know politics better than anyone. Yeah. Hey, this is your answer to this. This is your answer to this. I felt like he was very programmed.
To practice. Yeah.
And Bashir is a little like that, too. You look at him, then they start talking. I go, I don't know. You know, where I think.
Do you know who I think would be really formidable? Oh. The most formidable? I don't know if he's going to run. Stephen A. Smith.
He's not.
He says he's not, but just think about it. There's something very Trump-like about him. You know, he's not ideological per se. He kind of has a lot of common sense, says it like it is. You never quite know where he's going to land on a position. And he's entertaining and smart. I mean, that is somebody, you know, everybody talks about Michelle Obama or, you know, whatever. Stephen A. Smith is somebody that if he got in the race, I think people would be nervous.
Well, I like him as a person. Wes Moore, people, wow, good looking guy, man. Look at he's a
empty suit.
Unbelievable. By the way, did you see Washington Free Beacon is doing some stories on him? Nothing he says is true and accurate.
Yeah.
Like the things that he said he ran and things he said he did.
Liar.
Nothing holds up.
Yeah.
So that's all you need. He's already lying about his past. It's easily discoverable. That to me is maniacal.
Who do you think the Democrats are going to put up, Brian?
I mean, I'm running through with you, right? So we know Mayor Pete is running for sure.
But if Sean actually gets this ATC done, I think Mayor Pete's done. I'm sorry. I know I'm biased.
No, but like, he's the worst.
He's bad the most mayor, do-nothing person. Yeah, totally.
I mean, how about the fact that he took a car to his bike?
I know, he's such a phony.
So he could look like he's a green guy.
Such a phony.
And how about the fact Sean told me they never staffed? They were unstaffed the whole time. The guy was never in the office.
Honestly, when I, you know, we all knew he took
We know Sean Duffy, the Secretary of Transportation.
Yeah, he took that four-month vacation. He went to Portugal or some crazy stuff. He went away.
Yeah.
Sean can't get away for 4 hours. I mean, I can't.
Not if you want to do your job.
Not if you want to do your job. So anyway,
So let's work this out.
Okay.
So I think Bashir is going to run. And every time I say something positive about Bashir, I get killed from people from Kentucky going, do not fall for it. But he did win twice.
Yeah.
You know, okay. But they also give you Tom Massey and Rand Paul. So you got Bashir is going to run. Shapiro is going to run. Mayor Pete's going to run. Rahm Emanuel is going to run. Pritzker is going to run.
Gavin Newsom.
Gavin Newsom will run. Kamala Harris will run.
I think AOC will.
So I'm up to eight.
AOC.
Eight. Or Senate. I felt like she was really knocked down after that terrible display, right?
You're right. When she went to Europe as her, like...
She can't recover. Like, I think it, like, knocked her because she realized she was way out of her depth.
Yeah.
And she realized she had no comeback. You can't blame Trump.
Yeah.
You can't blame...
You're
right.
She's
going to
run for Senate. You're right.
Here's eight.
Okay.
So what... none of those eight seem to me to be solid candidates. So I'm trying to think of a Democrat, Jared Polis, charisma less, and he was fancying himself a moderate, but Trump has blown him up or exposed him, no matter how you want to look at it.
What do you think about Ro Khanna? Do you think Ro Khanna would?
He's running. He's in.
Yeah, and I think he is somebody who just sounds reasonable. I mean, maybe
I wish he was, but
I know he's not. And none of these guys are, right?
But just
part of it is, you know, just can I convince people in the middle, the independents? He's somebody who actually could convince somebody in the middle. So I think he's formidable. I think the wild card is Stephen A. Smith, and of course Gavin looks the part, which is half the battle.
Right. The problem is if he gets through a primary, they have the worst party ever. Because if I'm running against Gavin Newsom, I flip over and I go, what have you done as mayor? What have you done as governor? What has happened to your state since you took over? What have you taken responsibility? What have you flip-flopped on? What is done with the budget? Where have people got? I mean, if Ro Khanna and everybody we just mentioned runs against Gavin Newsom and they don't bring that up,
Yeah.
And if they bring it up and the Democrats go, I don't care, then Republicans can feast on this, I think. Because performance does matter.
Yeah.
What do you think? What is your execution?
You would say, you would think that, but then you have Kamala Harris. What did she ever do? And frankly,
she's a mistake. I mean, she was a mistake.
But what about Joe Biden? I mean, what has he ever done? Everything he's ever come out on in foreign policy, which is something that matters to you. Everything was wrong.
Everything, and continue to be wrong throughout his presidency. But Kamala Harris, you know this. Kamala Harris ascended to it really unscathed. She had one challenge as AG, and she barely survived it. And then she runs for president and falls flat on her face, wastes all that money. Everybody turns on her. And because Joe Biden said, I need a woman, and for Clyburn said, pick a woman of color, he was down to Val Demings, and he was down to Kamala Harris.
I think Karen Bass was also on that list.
Wow.
Yeah.
Think about that ineptness. Mm. Who friends with Castro.
Yeah. I mean, she worked for, like, she would go down. She was a revolutionary.
And that's because the political correctness destroyed them.
Yeah.
You walked into your own trap that you set for yourself.
Which is why I don't think they're going to make that mistake this time. I do think, like, Gavin Newsom has a shot because Kamala didn't work out. The other thing is,
they'd get a white guy.
Yeah, they think we have.
By the way, white men are the worst.
Yeah, thank you. That's what I keep saying, Brian.
Yeah, I keep saying
that. I do think that. I do think they're going to. I think the Democrats are very bruised and upset about, you know, what happened with Bernie Sanders, you know, how he got knocked out, then how they got Kamala Harris without really a primary. I mean, I think the base is very, very angry about how that turned out. So I think there's going to be a shot for something to mix it up. I keep thinking it's going to be, I don't know, somebody else.
Well, remember the last time they had a real primary was Obama against Hillary. They went down to the wire. Everybody was covering it. It was more exciting than the Republican race.
It really was.
And when he came back, Obama was a much better candidate because of Hillary.
Absolutely.
Right?
Iron sharpens iron, right?
Yeah.
You've got to have these primaries. And they don't like it. They like to anoint people.
Right.
Crown them.
You know why? They misinterpreted the result. They felt it divided their party. So they go, we don't want to do that again. So Hillary, sorry about last time as a woman. We did a horrible thing to women.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get it. Wait, you're losing. Bernie's winning. We can't have a socialist. We'll have no shot of winning. So we're going to put our hand on the scale. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz took the money that was, she basically had no money in the DNC, basically gave it to Hillary and to use the machine against Bernie. And then these emails come out to show that everyone's in cahoots to stop Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. And he's still a sucker.
And he never took a stand because he didn't want to be president. You know why?
Why?
He doesn't want to be president.
Why?
Because he can't run anything. He doesn't want the responsibility to back up that billionaires shouldn't exist and all these horror. He knows his policies will never work. He just likes talking about it.
I mean, he ran, though, Brian.
Right,
he ran.
That's why he didn't. To me, anyone who wanted to win would have went crazy after that.
The interesting thing is he's never really come out and gotten revenge for it. Like, even just exposing. He's always like they beat him up.
It's his party.
Yeah.
Kind of. It's his party. Also, he got Joe Biden. He stepped aside and gave Joe Biden that story. He goes, but you're going to do what I tell you.
This is what I love about Trump. When Trump, and sometimes it's hard to remember back to 2015, 2016. I mean, he was fighting his own party. He beat the Democrats, but he also beat the Republicans.
Romney.
He beat the machine, which is why he's so tough. And then the comeback is we'll never see anything like this ever again. I mean, he is absolutely, politically speaking, physically speaking, even after he got shot, he's the most courageous person, the strongest person ever seen in politics. In my lifetime.
I mean, think about it, Rachel. We were doing a show. How many times did we see him walk into court?
Every day.
Walking to court. Where's he doing? Today is for this. And today we have a hearing. And then
was it like 90 some charges?
And in and out, talking to the press every single time. And he's got to just sit there. Knowing everything he's got to do, he's got to sit there and he's got to take it. And in his mind, he never talked about, I got you back. Even that day at the Washington Correspondents' Dinner when Obama and Seth Meyers made fun of him. He just sat there and stared. Now, he could have said, hey, I thought I was never going to be president, Obama. Remember when you mocked me? He never says it. He doesn't need to. He's right.
But even though he was in those trials, remember how he'd make... He's always been able to make lemonade out of lemons. Remember, he'd come out And then he'd he'd have these press conferences.
Oh, when do we want a promo for you? Anything you have coming up? Are you going to be on Fox and Friends tomorrow?
I'm going to, unless you say I can't come.
Right. I just said that one time. And you were already on your way, and it was embarrassing.
You know what? The hours flew by for the last couple of days. I mean that with all sincerity.
It's fun, right?
I thought it was super fun this week with you and with Lawrence.
Right, great, but you're on it tomorrow?
Time. Yeah, I'm on tomorrow.
Okay, great.
I said no to Thursday because that's a holy day for me.
Holy Thursday.
Holy Thursday.
Back in a moment. Thanks, Rachel Campos-Duffy.
You got it.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
If you're not encouraging your children to grow up and have the courage to get married and have kids, more kids than they can afford before they think they're ready, it is high time to start. It is these choices, like deleting our dating apps and quitting birth control pills and saying I do at the altar, that ultimately trickle down into the political policies that we will see save our country.
So that is the message that came out on CPAC one day. Just that message was something. Yeah, Isabel Brown was speaking at CPAC. She's author and the host of the Isabel Brown Show. Talked about being pro-family. Don't worry about the money. Just work it out. Things will work out in America. Here's the response on The View. Cut 41.
What is she?
Ultimate beef with this is that it wraps a woman's worth up in her ovaries.
Bottom line, if you're not paying my bills, you don't get to tell me what I do with my uterus.
I think it's just really reckless to be suggesting that people should have children when you now know in this country there's this affordability crisis, and for a two-person household, a married household, you need over $400,000 for child care. Mm-hmm. Over $400,000. Most people don't make over $400,000. So she's advocating for people to be born into poverty, people not being able to feed those children, people not being able to educate those children, and people not being able to house those children.
So, Allison, do you think that's true? $400,000 for childcare? Are you sending him to Harvard?
It sounds insane. Like, I mean, I know it's a lot per year, but for 18 years, how are you calculating that?
She said for 1 year, I think.
No way.
In other words, just work it out. Have kids, it'll work out.
Yes.
Right? And put those kids to work. They could work for you. They don't have to wait until they're 30.
That's exactly what you did.